Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Faces of RFR. I'm Eric Wells. I'm the support group director for Recovering from Religion. And on this series, we get to sit down and talk with various volunteers around all of the different programs of Recovering from Religion. We get to know them. We get to see what makes them tick. And we also kind of understand why they volunteer for RFR and what they get out of it. So we have done this for quite a few interviews, and everyone has been awesome. And today is absolutely no exception. Today, I am very, very excited to introduce to you my friend, Chris. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Eric.
Good. It's really, really good to see you, man.
I'm really glad to be here.
I'm looking forward to kind of getting to know you. Like, we've known each other for several months now. I think that you are a support group leader in
Burlington, Vermont.
Yeah, Burlington, Vermont. Yeah,
and I also am on the hotline. I volunteer for the hotline for chats and calls.
Okay, so do you actually take the calls and you or do you have one or the other? Or do you do both?
I do both. I'm a multitasking helpline volunteer.
That's awesome. Well, we'll get into that in a little bit. But what do you do for a living? What puts food on the table for you?
So I'm a stay-at-home dad. It's one of my biggest things. I have the fortune that my wife has a career that is able to take care of our family financially. I'm a passive-house consultant. That's I design and model and help build super insulated houses that use almost no energy to heat and cool, and therefore have less of a carbon imprint on the culture, with an idea that all houses should be using as little energy as possible. And since we have the technology to do it, then why isn't every house built like that? So that's what I do during the day.
Well, I love it. Does it cost a little bit more to be as energy efficient, or do we have materials these days that cost just about the same, or, you know?
So it is true that the initial building cost is higher. I think the average is something on the order of 2 to 7% higher than a standard building style. However, the energy use is up to 80% less. So the second that you start using the house, you're automatically saving money that you normally would have put into fuel that can then be put towards a slightly higher mortgage. So it's a wash financially when you build a passive house. There are some exceptions. You build a passive house in Alaska, it's going to cost you more than building a code house in Alaska. But most environments, you can almost consider it a complete wash to build a super insulated house.
And you're in Vermont, which is like known for some pretty cold winters and such too. So you're building super energy efficient houses in a very cold region of the world. That's
yeah.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah. And the challenges that we have in Vermont are that it's not only very cold, but it's also very humid. And when you build a super insulated house, although this is a completely different discussion, I'd be happy to talk to people about this ad nauseum, is that you have durability issues when you start dealing with moisture. So we have to be very careful about building assemblies that allow for moisture to move in and out of them, depending on what the moisture loads are.
Yeah. And from what I recall, it's something like a Tyvek type of wrap, like that big old white sheet that you wrap around a whole house or something. Is that
so? One of the parts of designing a house that is very much tied to energy efficiency is air leakage, and when you have a house, getting your air leakage down is one of the easiest ways to reduce energy loss. Just think about having a house that's very leaky, that you have a 20 mile per hour wind blowing against it, If you have a house that's very leaky, all of that inside air that you've heated up to heat your house and stay warm is blown out of the house and replaced by freezing cold outside air. Instead of doing that, if I were to make the house very airtight, that infiltration, which is what that type of loss is called, would be reduced. And the first thing people say is, well, how am I going to breathe? There's no air coming in. Well, we have something called a balanced ventilation system, which brings air in from the outside and actually uses the heat of the air that you're, the stale air in the house, going through a heat exchanger to heat the incoming cold air. So we have fresh air coming in. The indoor air quality of these houses using these balanced ventilation systems is far superior than a normal code house. And we're able to make the house super airtight at the same time. So it's an integration of a number of different things. Air tightness is one of them. Higher insulation levels is another. Balanced ventilation and good windows that allow us to capture solar gains. Those are all part of the strategies for making super insulated houses.
How long have you been doing this kind of work?
I got certified in 2011, so I've been doing this for about 10 years.
Nice. When you're not designing great houses, what do you like to do in your free time?
My wife says that I am a medieval village on the road. I'm a amateur blacksmith, amateur woodworker, amateur sawyer. I volunteer for a summer camp called Frontiers Camp here in Vermont, where we act like it's the 1820s for a week. We have over 100 kids who come. Of course, this year we had to cancel because of COVID, but I'm a blacksmith at that program and a leader. It's a provisional Boy Scout camp. Basically that is my thing. I love history. I love looking at ancient buildings and old buildings and learning our history, because I'm a firm believer that if we don't understand our history, then we're doomed to repeat the bad parts and hopefully support the good parts. I'm also really interested in consciousness and philosophy. I'm interested in why people believe what they believe. And whether they can back up their beliefs under scrutiny. That's one of the things that brought me to recovering from religion, is I know that there are lots of people out there who are struggling with those types of questions. And although I certainly don't claim to have any answers, I do have some questions that I can ask that can help them follow their own path to figuring it out.
Sounds like you like both kind of creating and also educating a little bit.
Yeah. I'm a huge into educating. I was a teacher at the Technical College of Amsterdam for 6 years, where I taught technical drawing. My kids have a joke about when we go on vacation, I point at a building and say, "So where? What time era is that from?" So I'm constantly learning myself and constantly encouraging the people around me to learn as well, because more information can only make you better informed about the way that you're forming your beliefs about the world and how it is.
I'm going to slightly back up. You had said that you like to do blacksmithing and you like to do woodworking, but you also said sawyer as well. And most people can only really relate to Tom Sawyer and never really thought of it as an occupation of sorts. So what's a sawyer?
So a sawyer is a person who saws wood. That
makes sense.
It's pretty straightforward. You know, you've met people named Miller. Their ancestors were millers. Sawyers were sawyers. They sawed. I lived in the Netherlands for 10 years, between 2000 and 2010. And while I was there, I took a course of study to become a certified Dutch windmiller. So I'm also certified to run old-fashioned wooden mills. The mill that I was studying on for every Saturday for 3 years was a sawmill in the city of Haarlem, for which the town of Haarlem in New York City is named.
New York City used to be known as New Amsterdam, right?
It was.
So that would really kind of make sense as to why there may be some Dutch names around New York City area.
All over the place. Once you know Dutch, you understand that Flushing, which is a neighborhood in Queens, is a mispronunciation of the Dutch word Vlissingen, which is a city in the Netherlands. New Utrecht Straat, New Utrecht Street in Brooklyn. Coney Island is a mispronunciation of Konijn Island. Konijn is the Dutch word for rabbit. So it's actually Rabbit Island, Coney Island. It really did, growing up in New York City as I did, learning Dutch and spending time in the Netherlands completely changed my understanding of this city I grew up in and made it so much more interesting to walk around New York City and see Wall Street, on which there was a wall that separated the Dutch colony from, or the Dutch settlement from the rest of Manhattan. Broadway actually follows an old Native American trail, and I never knew that before. The Canal Street, I mean, just the history in general of the Netherlands and how that influenced a lot of things in New York are really sit very closely.
Now, have you ever really considered yourself to be religious? And if so, what's the story behind that? How'd you get into it? How'd you get out of it? Are you still in it?
Yeah, good question. So my father grew up in Kansas in a mostly non-religious but nominally Baptist family. By the time he got out of the army after he served during Korea, he was completely atheist himself. As a matter of fact, when he was asked to write down on his card for the army what his religion was so they could get the proper chaplain to him should he die, he found some obscure African tribe that was listed as being Satanists, and he wrote that down as his religion. So very tongue-in-cheek. My mother is a first-generation Russian Jew, so my grandparents came from Russia at the turn of the 20th century, 1900 to the 1800s to the 1900s. And I grew up in a very kind of secular, non-religious Jewish environment because my father's family was so far away. Most of the relatives that I interacted with were my Russian Jewish family, a very large extended family. Both my grandparents, one of eight children.
Wow.
So I grew up in a family. Another point that's very important is my father was a theatrical electrician. So I grew up surrounded by the arts. He was an electrician for a lot of very well-known shows on Broadway, Jesus Christ Superstar, Sweeney Todd, etc. He was the master electrician. So I grew up having friends over. My parents' friends were all different colors and sexual orientations. So from a very young age, I was surrounded by people and thought it was completely normal to be any of these things. There was no push to be religious, but when I was about 8 or 9, I felt that I was missing something because my friends were going to church. So I started going to church with one of my best friends. It was a Southern Baptist church in Berkeley Heights or in Summit, New Jersey, I think it was. And we would go to a sermon, which was boring as all heck, but then we'd go and do kid group. And I was told that I needed to learn the names of all of the chapters of the Bible, the New Testament, the Old Testament, be able to recite that. And I was getting instruction in morality and felt very much drawn to the idea of a God and the idea that Jesus was there and God was his father and all that sounded perfectly okay to me. I had certainly an internal discussion with who I thought in my head was God or the Holy Spirit or whatever it was. But it was all me. When I didn't want to go to church on Sunday because I didn't want to, I just told my friend I wasn't interested in going. And my parents were like, oh, you're still here. So there was no pressure at all from my family side. Although my own journey stayed with Christianity. When I was 11, my parents got divorced. We moved from a suburb of New York in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey, to New York City, where I was living in Park Slope in Manhattan, depending on which parent I was staying with. And there, my father hired a woman to take care of us after school, who was a Jehovah's Witness. And I still to this day have a Jehovah's Witness Bible that she gave me. Although I never went to any meetings, I did get some instruction from her. And I was very, very strong in my belief that there was a God and that Jesus was a guy and he was the Son of God. And I read the Bible, but I was not involved in a community at all. So that whole thing that I hear from Christians, that leaving their belief was hard because they were torn from this community, was not something I ever had an issue with. For a long time, I was just kind of, let's say, from 14 to out of high school with various girlfriends and other things. I would go to church with them when they went to church, but I was not particularly fervent in my belief. When I got to college, my first time in college, I studied cultural anthropology, which I highly recommend as a interesting study, but not as a career path. Although there are plenty of good career paths there, just not one that I took. I ran into a bunch of people in college who were practicing Wiccans. And I was fascinated, something wonderful about this occult. Of course, occult just means hidden, right? So this hidden knowledge that is ancient that we're rediscovering. And I started reading all of the Starhawk and all the different authors from the revival. This is in the mid to late 80s in upstate New York at SUNY Purchase. And I started doing pagan stuff. And for me, there was no, I'm hurting God by doing this, because there's no internal friction there for me personally. I'm sure that if someone was outside who had a much more strict Christian upbringing, would say those two things are not related, but for me they were not unrelated. It was both spiritual, it was both dealing with the sacred, as it were. So there was no contradiction in my mind there. I didn't consider myself at that point to be a Christian. I was learning about the history of the witch burnings and the Malus Maleficorum, which is the witch's hammer, the book that the Catholic Church wrote in order to be able to tell who is a witch and who isn't a witch and what you do with them, which was often very unpleasant. And the war against women, which is what the Wiccan community calls the burning times. And when I left college, I continued my interest in paganism in Wicca, and formed with a friend of mine probably when I was 25 or 26, a not-for-profit religious organization, which we called A Temple of the Apotheosis. And it was supposed to be a religious organization, 501c3 religious organization, that said there are many paths to the knowledge that we get from spirituality, and anyone is welcome, a Christian, a Buddhist, a pagan, a Satanist. It doesn't matter to us. As long as you're genuinely interested in your path and you're not going to be judging other people on their path to their own knowledge, that was our main thing. And we had Quakers involved. In the end, in Park Slope, we had probably a community of about 300 people who were rotating in and out, usually a group of about 30 or 40 people coming to our rituals. We had, we did the 8 solar rituals of the pagan calendar, the solstices, equinoxes, and the cross quarter days. So there were 8 holidays, one every 6 weeks. And for 7 years, we put on a ritual every 6 weeks. And had a roaring good time, and did some interesting passion plays and wrote stuff. And we were doing them in parks, and we were doing them in our own houses. And We were having a grand old time. And at the same time, I was delving into Thelema and the Ordo Templi Orientis, which is just a Thelemic or a Kabbalah-based way to truth again. And what I was really looking for from both groups was initiation, because one thing I hadn't gotten from Christianity was the baptism. I didn't have, you know, the catechism or any of these rites of passage, and I was really looking for some rites of passage. So I went and found a group that's pretty much, that's all they do, right? This is a group that's based on the Masonic rites, the higher levels of the Masonic rites, if you were to listen to the founders of the organization. And I was really, 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 really trying hard to find real supernatural evidence, evidence of anything supernatural. I had a friend of mine who was really into Santeria, and we would do rituals for a whole night and dancing and drinking and getting ourselves into to states of altered states, and still nothing that I would consider to be a supernatural event ever occurred. And anytime something occurred that was even questionable, we were able to chalk it up to, look, I'm just a brain observing this, and brains do weird shit, and that is my brain doing weird stuff. So at the end of all that, when the whole thing kind of petered out, which is more through my lack of interest, because I was one of the main driving forces, because I was not finding anything other than community. And community is great, but it wasn't what I was looking for from this organization. I finally came to the decision that I did not believe in the supernatural. And that was enough for me to not do that anymore. And then I went out and got a degree in engineering, moved to the Netherlands, you know, had a couple of kids, was a stay-at-home dad, moved back to the U.S. after 10 years of living in the Netherlands. And about 4 years ago, started getting into modern atheism, watching shows from the ACA, at first on vacation in Dublin, and happening upon Matt Dillahunty having a discussion with a Christian from probably 2012 or something. It was an old one, even when I saw it, where the guy he was talking about was saying, well, you're just much smarter than I am. And Matt saying, how do you know that, first of all? And second of all, who cares if I'm smarter than you? What does that got to do with whether it's true or not? And I was like, now we're getting somewhere. So that was my introduction to epistemology, and now I'm all about epistemology and asking people to look at their own assumptions about the world critically, and hopefully in a compassionate way that doesn't drive them away, saying, you're just saying I'm a bad person. No. Like I said earlier, I like what Eric Murphy does and Lee LaBianca do on Pac Heathen, when they say it's your tools we're questioning, not you. You're a perfectly good person as far as we can tell. It's just that you've been given some tools and you're using these tools in a way that is not getting you a reliable path to the truth. And that's really where I'm at now. That's my journey.
Well, it sounds like you've come like full circle, starting out as a kid kind of in a really secular household and then trying out different things in search of spiritual truth. And then you've landed here as a non-believer now these days. How would you describe your current beliefs?
My current beliefs are pretty much, I believe I'm to throw some big words, I'm a soft solipsist. I don't believe that I can prove that I'm not in the matrix. I'm not a brain in a vat somewhere, and you are all just a figment of my imagination, but I'm going to act like the world really exists because that's how I survive in this environment. And I have no evidence of any supernatural existence at all. Although I'm open to seeing it. And to be perfectly honest, if you watch my journey, I was not just open, but I was out there on the bleeding edge trying to find any proof that there is something supernatural. But I've always been a critical person. Yeah. So I'm not going to see you know, a flag waving between two flags that aren't waving and say, oh, that's proof of God. No, I understand there's enough, you know, there's enough in the world that we can, with a good amount of data, give a scientific explanation for. And there's enough I know about how my brain sees a lot and then throws most of that out. And what my consciousness actually observes is a fraction of what's actually happening. And once I get to there, I can really start questioning all of the things that I'm seeing in a much more critical light. But also to look at you, Eric, and say, did you see that too? Do you agree with that? And then send it to someone in Australia or in Japan. One of the things I heard someone say not so long ago, which I thought was brilliant, and I'll have to find that so I can properly cite them, was you'll hear about beliefs. You say, oh, that's an Eastern belief, or that's a Yoruba, that's a Nigerian belief, or Islam, or this type of Islam, or that type of Islam, or this type of Christianity. Well, we'll talk about all these beliefs as a regional thing or a thing within a group, but we don't say African science or, you know, Far Eastern science. No, science is the thing that cuts through all of it. And using and applying the scientific method in a way which is repeatable and demonstrable and falsifiable is the best pathway to truth. It's why we have all the things we have. It's why I can speak to you, you know, through the ether, as it were, as they used to say, phlogism, right? That this is the right path. This is the only thing that has given demonstrable results that are things that we can use over and over. I love the fact that we have real scientific data on the fact that intercessional prayer doesn't work, and that the Templeton Foundation, which is trying to prove that intercessional prayer works, was the one who funded it. I think that that's where we get to when we're having these conversations and we use science as the basis. If tomorrow something were to happen that were a good indication or evidence for believing in any of the beliefs that we have around us, I would be open to hearing it and putting it to the test. I certainly would not accept it as true on face value. I'd certainly want a lot of critical minds and a lot of data looking at it first, but I'm open to being convinced.
You've experienced like so many different types of belief systems through your and like jumped in to the deep end on all of them. What was there anything that was like very difficult for you to overcome? Some sort of way of thinking or some sort of attachment that you had. What was like the hardest thing you had to overcome after coming out of your beliefs?
My personal demons are all psychological. My personal demons are all based on having a father with anger management problems and a mother with manic depression, and living in the 1970s in New Jersey under those conditions and surviving a divorce, and all of it is very mundane. None of my issues with life are anything that have to do with me losing a belief. It's all very, very icky and real, and I can point to it and say, that's what happened. And in that vein, when I'm confronted with those things, I do my best to face them head on and not run away from them. Yeah. And that's probably the hardest work ever. I mean, I could have gone and done a Sufi inner journey for a year and not gotten as far as three sessions of good psychotherapy, and actually getting to what's going on inside of me. I may be wrong about that, but that's my perception of it. So that's my reality. And I never had a problem either picking up or dropping a spiritual belief. And there's never been any supernatural retribution for any of my choices.
You mean you've never been struck by lightning or anything like that?
I haven't. I know people who have, which, by the way, the chances of getting struck by lightning are really small, but the chances of knowing someone who was struck by lightning are slightly larger.
Let's talk about let's talk about recovering from religion a little bit. How did you first hear about RFR?
Straight up, I heard about it on the ACA programs. I was listening to the ACA. It was more than one of them because they all give you guys and us guys as RFR lots of airtime whenever they're talking to someone with a real deep issue. They say, look, this is a call-in show and we can talk for 5 minutes about this, but after that it's done. And if you want to talk to someone on a longer term basis who will have people who can really channel you into the right direction, then talk to the people from RFR. And when I decided I wanted to activate and not just sit on the sidelines and watch programs, but actually get in and start talking to people and helping people, that's when I called RFR, and that was earlier this year. It's a good fit. I like helping people. I like talking with people. I'm curious about people's thoughts and beliefs. And I know enough people who have been seriously injured by their upbringing in a religious environment that I know that there's a need for compassionate ears and good information and resources.
Now, when you say ACA, that's the
Atheist Community of Boston. Yeah,
and they've got the Atheist Experience, and they've got Talk Heathen, and
Truth Wanted, and Godless Sexuality. Bitches. Secular Sexuality, and I think Atheist Vanguard. That covers pretty much all of their. I listen to all of them.
They're just great, fantastic shows.
Yeah.
They're really good stuff, too. What do you get out of volunteering for Recovering from Religion?
I consider, I like helping people. I get a rush from feeling that I'm useful. Now my kids are older. I'm a little less useful to them than I used to be. And I consider myself a person who needs to be a part of the solution. And I consider the pain and suffering that is caused not to everyone by any means, but to the people who are negatively affected interactions with their beliefs. There are a lot of them, and they need to be helped. That is something that I know I can do, and I like doing that. Straight up altruism and the juice I get from being a part of a community, helping people. It's like what I'm reading, The Selfish Gene right now by Richard Dawkins. And he says, although it seems like altruism shouldn't be selfish, it's actually completely selfish. Once I was on the subway in Amsterdam, on the way into Amsterdam from the suburb I was living in, and I just looked around at everybody and I was like, why are we not all just killing each other? Why are we not all, you know, jumping up and knocking each other out and taking each other's stuff? And I was like, but that's not good for me. It's not good for me to live in a society where if I think I'm going to step outside, I'm going to be a victim. It's much better to live in a society where if I walk outside and I hurt myself, I think someone's going to help me. And that's selfish. So it's a completely selfish thing for me to want to volunteer to help other people, because when I want help, I want there to be other people out there to help me. And that seems kind of silly, but that's exactly what it is for me.
Yeah. No, I totally relate too. I get a thrill out of helping others, and I feel better about myself, and you know, I get a rush of good feelings. In some sense, it's totally selfish to kind of do these good deeds and do this kind of work, but it's still making a big difference too. It's kind of like get both good things are happening.
and I just want to, for me, making a little difference is as big as making a big difference, right? Because every little difference stacks up.
Yeah.
And so there's a horrible but wonderful movie, What About Bob, with Bill Murray. And the joke is that Richard Dreyfuss's character has written this book called Little Steps. And the little step program is you just take a little step a little further and you get to your goal. And it's lampooned through the whole movie because the main character, Bob, doesn't follow it at all. And Richard Dreyfuss's character is going nuts and doesn't really believe in this thing that he's making a lot of money selling his book and all this thing. But in the end, it's a lot of little things that are successful are much better than, and they make that big difference, right? So if I have a conversation with someone and at the end of that conversation, a chat or a phone call with RFR, and someone says, thank you, that helped, that's enough for me.
Yeah. What do you see in the future for your work with RFR? What would keep you going and keep you in continuing to volunteer?
I'm a dive in kind of guy. So I started volunteering on the helpline in February, and I started up the local group in March. So I was like, okay, I don't just want to see people virtually. I want to see people in person, and then COVID happened, right? So we had one meeting trying to build up a group here and get a community together, and COVID happened, and that's really put a damper on me trying to get something going here. And as things loosen up, my goal for my work with RFR is to get a good solid community here in the Burlington area, Chittenden County and environs working. And my goal of any of the projects that I'm working on is to create a group that can survive without me. So that if at some point something happens, I have a health crisis or, you know, I have to move out of the country because of whoever knows what. And fortunately, I can always move to the Netherlands. That's my immediate goal. And that will keep me going as a goal right now. And just helping people. I'm interested in hearing the stories and being an open ear and offering resources to people. In the same vein, I'm interested in street epistemology and going out and asking people, why do you believe what you believe? Let me sit down and throw some Socrates at you and see if we can delve into this a little and not at all be confrontational, and you can walk away at any minute, but I'm critical of my own beliefs. And if you have a question that can make me think about what I believe to be true and you can shake that a little, then I've learned something too. So knowing that this is the only opportunity I get to do anything as a living being gives me a bit of fire to actually do things. I don't always fulfill those desires. I'm as lazy as the next person, which my wife would get me. She always gets upset when I say I'm lazy, even though I feel that I'm very lazy. But what keeps me going and keeps me involved with RFR, first of all, is the mission. I know that there's a community of people out there. I know that they need help, and it's help that I can offer. It's not a huge amount of study to do it. I just have to have a big open heart and be willing to help people and be willing to spend the time to learn the right way to do it and to listen to people like Daryl Ray who are guiding us all and helping us understand. When they came out with the idea of a religious traumatic, designation for a psychological problem, I'm like, yes, I'm not that guy, but I know people who are suffering from religious trauma, and that is a thing. And I want to help, in even if I'm just the pebble in the concrete that's the foundation of the building that is working on that, I'm okay with that because we need the pebbles.
Yeah.
You can't do it alone. You can't do it without the rest of the stuff.
Yeah. I love that. I like that a lot. It's very poignant, and I can get behind that. All right, so I got one last question. I like asking this question at the end to like all of the guests, and it's kind of a weird one, but I haven't heard it very often. If you could travel back in time and talk to your past self, who would you talk to and what would you talk about?
I'd like to choose a point in my life where me talking to me would make a difference, right? Because there's plenty of me back there that would not have listened to me at all. Mm-hmm. This is very deep and very personal, but I'd probably go back to a very young self and tell me that it'll be okay, because all of the uncertainty that I went through in my childhood with the anger bursts that my dad would have and the inability my mother had because of her traumatic depression to protect me from his anger and that dynamic, if I could just know that it was going to be okay and that I was going to make it okay, that would really make a difference for me, I think, because a lot of the stuff that I'm still dealing with as an adult in therapy and trying to work through might be less hard to work through if I'd known that.
You would like go back and talk to yourself to like steel yourself for what was to come, but always knowing that it's going to turn out just fine.
Yeah. So the therapy that I do is the internal family therapy, IFT, which is where you look at parts of you, not that there are separate parts, but we compartmentalize a lot of our experiences. And a lot of those parts were developed and developed coping strategies when we were very young. And those coping strategies may have been successful in getting you through whatever it was, but they're often very badly thought out because they're created by like a 5 or 6 year old mind. But they're also the ones we go to automatically as soon as we have a threat or a trigger. And so the therapy that I do is actually what I just said. I'm going back and talking to a 5-year-old me that just stood there and got screamed at by my dad for 2 hours about how worthless I was and said, it's okay. He's not really angry. Mm. It's not you. It's him. And, you know, tears and all kinds of stuff happen, and then a kind of reintegration happens. So what I'm doing actually in therapy now is what I would do if I had the opportunity to go back.
That sounds
now, talk to any individual person in history, that's a different question.
yeah, that is a different question. It sounds very powerful, that form of therapy, like imagining talking to your younger self. Wow, I hadn't heard about that before, and yeah, I could see the power in it.
It's a Jungian-based therapy.
Okay.
Carl Jung, yeah.
How long have you been doing that?
I started last year.
Okay.
I've taken a break just because my therapist is too busy and I'm not in crisis currently. I got to say, I have always thought myself to be a very steady and unshakable person. And I had an event happen last year and I had a nervous breakdown, and it was the first time in my life where I just had no solution.
Wow.
And I never thought I'd ever get there because I grew up with a mother with manic depression. That was a real big fear of mine. And I went through and I got out of it. And I just want to say, it's okay to have a nervous breakdown. If you're having it, have it, but get help and then make sure you have a support group around you to help you through it. But it's not the end of anything. You know, there's a lot of help to be had.
Chris, this was a fantastic talk. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us and letting us get to know you a little bit better. You know, like I said, you and I have known each other since March, and this is like the first time we really get to know you. And I feel like I look forward to getting to see you more and more in the upcoming months as we work together. So thanks so much, man.
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to share my story.
Yeah. Do you have any last words you wanted to say before we sign off here?
I'd just like to say that I think that the RFR is doing amazing and important work, and I'm very honored to have an opportunity to help with that.
Got it. Thank you, Chris. Thank you so much. This wraps up another episode of Faces of RFR. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to have more of these. I've got a lot more on the books that we're get scheduled and edited and thrown up on YouTube. If you are interested in volunteering for RFR, at least seeing what it's all about, go to our website, recoveringfromreligion.org, and you can click around there. You can test out the chat line feature, give them a call. When you're ready to volunteer, click on the volunteer tab and go through that process. We've all gone through it, and it's been well worth the time and effort that we've put into volunteering. So thank you guys, and we will see you next time. See ya.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.